Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old Vernon Martin of Bakersfield, California. I want to thank one of our longtime listeners there on affiliate KNZR, David Gifford, for letting me know about his Uncle Vernon, who told us about growing up in the tiny town of Eldon, Oklahoma. He got his first taste of California in 1939 when he came out with family and spent the summer picking peaches in Modesto. When he passed through Bakersfield on that trip, little did he know he'd end up spending most of his life there as a plumber and pipe fitter. He's been in Bakersfield since 1956, but let's go back into his World War II story now. After volunteering to go overseas, he was sent to Camp Roberts in Paso Robles, California, to join the 602nd Field Artillery Battalion.
Well, when I got there, the 602nd came back from Kiska. They gave them all furloughs, and they was just a skeleton crew there, maybe 15 men out of the whole battalion. Our commanding officer sent them all a telegram, get back as fast as you can, because the Army said that we had to be in Italy at a certain time. So they all come back in, and I was new in the outfit. The 23 guys that came in, they all looked down on us because they'd been to Kiska and been in combat and everything, and we were just new.
Uh-huh.
And they never let us get ahead.
I'm sure they didn't. And your battalion has a pretty unique distinction. Before you joined it, they made that amphibious landing up in the Aleutians at Kiska, and then you would be part of an airborne assault in August of 1944 in southern France. And in between, you're working with mules in the mountains. I don't know too many units that did that variety of things. It's a pretty unique outfit you had there.
Well, we landed in Italy, and they rounded up these mules someplace. They put us on a train and shipped us to the southern part of Italy.
So the mules didn't come with you?
No, they brought them in later, but they were really not the mules that we was used to, but they made out all right. And they brought those mules in, and none of them was broke to saddle and carry loads. So we would take five men, one man on each mule's ear, and then one man with a twitch. You know what a twitch is?
Tell us.
It's a stick about this long, and it's got a rope in it, the whole drill through, and a rope in there plaited together, and it's about this long. And they take that, and they take the bottom lip of the mule, and they put this rope on there and twist it.
Right.
And that's what you hold a mule with.
Uh-huh.
And then two men would take the saddle and put on the mule and cinch it down and take a bag of oats and tie onto the mule and turn him loose and let him go, and he'd run off through the fields bucking, and that was the way we broke them.
Well, and it just kind of strikes me, here you'd spent all this time training with mules. I'm sure they never taught you how to break in a mule. You guys had to probably figure that out on your own after you're already over there in a war zone. Yeah, thanks a lot. And I know we're jumping around, but what about the ride over there? What about the voyage across the ocean?
Well, when it come time for us to go, I might should not say this, but you have to take a physical. All we had on was a pair of combat boots and a slicker and our helmet. No clothes underneath that.
Uh-huh.
And we marched down the street at this Camp Patrick Henry to a doctor to inspect us.
Right.
And all we had to do was just walk in, just pull our slicker back, and there we was, stark naked. I bet no very few people ever done that.
Marched with just combat boots, a helmet, and a slicker on? Yeah. Likely not.
They put us on the boat, and it sat there in the port. By the time we got out to the ocean, why, it was dark. But the next morning we woke up, and as far as you could see was ships. I don't know how many there was on there. We was next to a British ship. We was kind of on the outside, which is a bad place to be.
Yeah, there's submarines around for sure.
Yeah, well, they tried to get us.
You guys had an encounter with U-boats?
Oh, yeah, and sub chasers. They run right by our boat. We thought they was going to run into us. Off the back of it was rolling these big barrels, depth charges.
Yeah.
It makes a heck of a boiling of water and all that.
Sure.
And they wasn't too far from our boat.
So you're watching this show?
Yeah.
From the deck of your ship?
Uh-huh.
As a 19-year-old kid?
Yeah.
One big adventure, huh?
Among a lot of others. But no, it's silly to say you can look back on that and enjoy it. Right then, it was pretty serious.
Uh-huh.
But then, it's a learning experience. It took us 28 days to cross from there to Sicily, and they put us in there, and then we got in the air raid.
As soon as you got there, first night.
First night.
And you haven't debarked the ship. You're still on the ship. And what do you see?
Well, first thing come on was these big 20 million candle power lights. I don't know what candle power they are, but they're huge things. They was on shore, and they pick up these German planes, and then the anti-aircraft starts firing at them. They never bothered our ship or anything. As soon as they got out of range, well, they shut all that down. I don't know where the planes went. They was probably 12 planes or something like that.
But you're seeing the planes coming in and the tracers going up, and it's quite a show for your first night there.
It's a big show. The next morning, they started the ship up, and we landed in Naples. Got off a boat there at Naples, and there was some kind of a university or something on shore there. And Army had took over that, and that's where we stayed. We stayed there for maybe a week, and they put us on a train, and we went south out of there. If you've never rode a train, you should ride one of those European trains. It's really an adventure. Most of the time, you're in a cattle car. But this is just like you could look over the sides. But anyhow, we got down there, and they gathered the whole battery together, and we got a tent. We slept on the ground for a long time, and it rained, and water would run under there, and it was very uncomfortable. But then they got us folding cots, and then that's whenever we got the mules in there and began training them.
So you had to start from scratch with all these mules that needed to be broken in and train them to carry these loads. And how did that work with one of these howitzer teams? How was that all divvied up?
It took 6 mules to carry one gun.
Uh-huh.
That gun broke down into 6 different pieces. But everybody in the crew knew how to do everything on the gun. You could fire the gun. You could do all the ammo. I took care of the ammo most of the time.
Uh-huh. And it's a 75 millimeter?
Uh-huh. And it had a shell that the powder bags went in.
All right.
And my job, they had time fuses, and they had instant fuses, and they had delayed fuses, and then they had smoke. If they wanted this round to go off at so many feet above the ground, well, I set the timing on it. I had a little wrench. You could set the seconds and everything on it, and I'd set that. Once it was so far out of the muzzle of that gun, it automatically armed that round.
Right.
However many seconds you'd set on that, it got to that, and that was whenever it exploded. You wanted it to explode like 20 feet above the ground because of the shrapnel would spread out.
So you said 6 mules for every gun. How many men for every gun?
We had 14 men in a section. We could set our gun up with the crew on it. You had the gunner, chief of section, and you had number one man and the ammunition man and the trail man that moved the trail around to help line it up. We could take and set this gun up, and those mules would be in line, and we could tear that gun down and take it and put it on those mules, move 50 yards, take it off, and set it up and fire around in less than 2 minutes.
Wow.
That was the way that they trained us.
It's like a NASCAR pit crew or something. And how did the mules handle when you actually fired that sucker?
They'd take them off and a ways on a picket line. But the mules, we was in this place just out of Rome in the big tall trees, and first sergeant would come out. He was from Chicago, Illinois. I really got along good with him. He was an excellent Army man. And he'd scream out, "Bag 'em out." That meant get the feed bags and go down and get their food and take it and put it around there. It fit over their neck and up under their mouth mm-hmm. for them to eat. And as soon as that sergeant said those words, those mules just start braying. They knew exactly what was coming.
I could ask you a lot of seemingly dumb questions, but here's one of them. When you've got 6 different mules in your team, and who knows how many total mules you end up working with throughout the war, can you tell one mule from another?
My mule was a gray mule.
Yeah?
You could tell it any place. But all of them, you could tell your mule. I'll tell you, whenever I was taking basic training in Fort Sill, the animal came first. Nobody got to do anything, any comforts or anything, until every mule was taken care of. And there were certain procedures that you had to do to that mule. You know, curry it down, clean its all of its hoofs out. That mule had to be spotless. I had this mule down there in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And you could, it was a mouse-colored mule, and you could not pick up its back feet unless you wanted to get hurt. So this first or second lieutenant, I think he was, come by, and they'd watch you to see if you were doing it according to procedure. And he watched me, and I'd never picked up his back feet and cleaned them out. You got a knife where you take them and clean them all out and get all everything that's stuck up in their hoof out.
Right.
Well, I didn't do that. And he come over there and he said, "Private Martin, you never cleaned those back feet out on that mule." And I said, "No, sir." I said, "That mule's kind of mean." And he said, "Well, I'll clean them out." This mule laid it on him. He must have knocked him 15 feet.
I bet he never made that mistake again.
No, he, as far as I know, nobody ever cleaned that mule's back feet out.
Did he have anything to say to you afterwards?
Mm-mm.
So when you're working with all these guys and all these mules, does it feel like those animals are a part of the team too, or almost as important or valuable as the people?
Those mules were more valuable than any man. That mule came first, regardless. Before you could do anything to comfort yourself. Whenever we marched, we'd march for 50 minutes and then had a 10-minute break. But the first thing you had to do was be sure your saddle was right, the load was right, the harness on the mule was right before you got to take a break.
What about when you were actually in combat firing those howitzers? What were those situations like? What do you remember about maybe even the first time that you had to put that thing together and let her rip?
Okay, we went up to a little town north of Naples called Minterno. That's where I first went in combat. But they left the mules in the back, and they left people back there to take care of them. I don't know how long we was up there before the push come off that we took Rome, and at the same time they went in from England and took France over there.
Right.
It happened all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. So what are you doing? You're loading the shells in the gun?
Yeah.
And it's firing as fast as you can get them in there?
Well, you get a farting order. And then they say fire two rounds. Generally, one of the guns will fire a round for sighting the guns in.
And you can't see what you're shooting at, probably, right?
No, you don't see it.
You've got a forward observer who's telling you, try this bearing.
Well, they told you the exact bearing. Our command post at our outfit did. They give you the elevation, sideway movement, and then SI. It had an SI deal on there, which I never did find out for sure what it was. But they'd give you an SI setting on that.
And then they're giving you adjustments because you might be too short or too far and they want to zero you in on the target.
Yeah.
So you just keep firing and firing and firing. At what point do you start having fire directed toward you?
Well, a lot of times it's happened before you start firing. And that's happened several times. In fact, my buddy got wounded in that. We was in France. We went in with those gliders, and then we was up in a bare space between two grape vineyards. We was sitting there, hadn't done anything, and all at once did a puff of white smoke come up out in front of us, which was the Germans getting to know what settings on their gun. And so then, instead of firing smoke, they started firing shrapnel shells. There was a big gully behind us, and it was a lot coming in. So me and Brown, my buddy, we ran back through this vineyard about less than my fence out there, and then got over in this ditch, great big ditch, like 15 feet deep. And we got up again the bank, and I looked over, and blood was running out of the side of Brown's face, out of his head. And I said, "Brown, you've been hit." And sure enough, he had. Then we went back up to the gun. They knocked two of our guns out. But I was ammunition man. They gave the firing order, what were the elevation and all that is. And they said, "Fire at will," which you just as far as fast you can. And being an ammunition man, why, it got so fast that I couldn't set all this stuff on there.
Right.
So whatever I picked up, I handed to them. If it was a smoke shell, I handed it to them. If it was an instant fuse, I handed that to them. If it was the delayed fuse, whatever it was, I handed over there and they fired it. I don't know how many rounds we fired, but it was a lot. They'd moved all the artillery as close to the front as they could get it. We were sitting like 600 yards from the German lines. But they'd moved this 8-inch howitzers, 155 long toms.
Yeah.
They'd moved them all up as close as they could get them. And then whenever the big push comes on, you could sit there and read a newspaper, how light it was, and that was at 11:15 at night.
Because the artillery is lighting up the sky.
They had it strung all the way back, I don't know, like 4 or 5 miles. At that time, it was the largest artillery barrage that had ever been fired.
Was it scary?
Well, would I be bragging if I said, no, it wasn't. It was not scary.
It's kind of exciting?
It was very exciting, all of that firing going on. And the Germans were mad, too, and they was firing at us.
Right. Well, you mentioned when your buddy Brown got hit. Is that the closest it came to getting you when he got hit, or did you have some other close calls?
Yeah, we had, whenever we got to France, we landed in those gliders, and then we went up the coast, went all the way back to Italy again, within about a mile of Italy. We took Monte Carlo, we took Nice, France, and all of those towns up the side.
But you had a close call over there, too? Is that where you were leading into?
Several. I don't want to talk about that.
They hear you talking. You're 92 years old. They can tell how sharp your memory is. They can tell that you're humble and you're not looking to brag. But I get the sense that you were pretty fortunate to be here, that it could have been you a couple times there.
Yeah, I think it could have. I had to get back to my wife. If you get scared, you'd be scared all the time he's there. So you got to where you could live with it.
Right.
I don't know what the other people say about it.
But that's how you dealt with it.
Yeah, pretty soon you just got to where you could live with it.
It's time for another break, but when we come back, we'll hear more about Vernon Martin's experience in a glider as part of Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France in August 1944. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.